This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It kind of feels like kind of a wrap of what I've been doing. It really is a nice completion. I can just go home and die now.
We fail to ask the important questions. How much is enough? Are there no limits? One species, us, is single-handedly altering the planet. We have become a force of nature. There's no environment out there, and we are here. We are the environment. Let me introduce myself. My name is David Takayoshi Suzuki. The repercussions of Pearl Harbor were the defining events in my life. For my dad and mother, it must have been an absolutely brutal time. Just seeing this, they were really Japanese. I was young, I was very ambitious.
He was full of passion.
I wanted to publish the paper that people would read and go, wow.
Well, I never realized this was going to be such a big deal. Today, we can begin to look ahead and imagine a new way of living in harmony and balance.
However many years I have left, each year will be a gift.
David Suzuki is an internationally renowned geneticist, environmentalist, co-founder of the David Suzuki Foundation, author of more than 40 books, recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, Companion of the Order of Canada, holds multiple honorary degrees, and has been adopted into 3 First Nations clans. David is one of those unique individuals who challenges and inspires us, who presents us with the stark reality of the dangers that our Earth faces, but gives us the hope and confidence that we can save, repair, and create a better world. So tonight, I'd like to welcome David Suzuki.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. This is really the launch of the first night of trip across the country talking about both the book and the film. So thank you very much for such a great show up for this one tonight. Some of the material that I'm going to cover was part of the lecture that I gave for the Legacy lecture at UBC. I hope there may be a few of you here that heard that, but if you feel, oh God, I've heard this before, too bad. Thank you for coming. In many universities, there's a tradition where an esteemed or an eminent professor at the end of her or his career is asked to give a final lecture, a summation of knowledge accumulated over an academic career. No one ever asked me to do that at UBC. But when I was, and I taught at UBC for 39 years, but when I was asked to be part of a feature film, it was decided that we would do a final lecture, as if I was at the end of my career or at the end of my life, whatever, and that we would stage it at the Chan Center at UBC. And that became the spine of the film. When one hits 70 years of age, you can't deny that you're old. And that where I call it the death zone. We're in the death zone. There's nothing morbid about that. We're all going to die. And we'd better accept it and get on with the final job in our life. We've got to reflect back over that life and sift through experiences, observations, and thoughts to distill a legacy, something to pass on to future generations. I was asked a few months ago by a reporter who said, well, what do you want people to say about you after you're gone? And I was absolutely stunned by that question, because my answer was, I don't give a shit what they say about me after I'm gone. I'm going to be dead. Once we're gone, what difference does it make? A legacy implies a gift or something to leave on. And for me, that is a few ideas that I'd like to share with you tonight that I hope will continue to be pondered after I've kicked the bucket. You know, Moses Neimer is now an elder, but he doesn't like to be called an elder. So he's invented this term, Zoomer. You know, and I have this image of somebody in a wheelchair zooming around. Well, I just think that's a lot of crap. I think we should be called tumors, you know? These are people who know we're at the end of our lives, and so we can offer a great gift that age brings. We can say it like it is without worrying about salaries or money or honors or power. We're at the end of our life, and we can speak from the heart. And so I offer my legacy and hope that it will prompt every one of you, even though you are not elders, it will prompt you to begin to wonder about your own lives and what legacy that you would like to leave. To ask questions like, what is life all about? What matters the most in our lives? And what brings us the greatest joy and happiness? I began my career, my adult career, in 1961 after I got my PhD and became a scientist. And looking back over the speeches that I've given since that time, it's interesting to see the shifts in the material that I covered. I was trained as a geneticist, and so for years my early speeches were all about concerns about eugenics and cloning and genetic engineering. But then there was a fight against nuclear war as the superpowers were arming with nuclear weapons in crazy amounts. There were civil rights issues that I was concerned with, and of course the Vietnam War that we were concerned about here, and the environmental movement that began in the 60s. Fights against clear-cut logging in this province and air pollution and mega dams. And we were pressing for years for preservation of wilderness and better laws to protect the air, the water, the soil. And we were asking politicians to tax things that we don't like. Then about 30 years ago, Tara and I, my wife and I, became involved with First Nations people, and we've never left with friends and family among the First Nations. So as I look over the many issues that we've been involved in over a lifetime, I realize that the issues over time have changed, but the age-old questions keep coming up over and over. Who the hell are we? How did we get here? And what's it all about? Now, in the past, every culture had its own answers to those questions. We have them in our creation myths. The Norse myth, for example, tells of the giant Ymir, who, when he was murdered, his skull and his hair and his blood and his bones became the heavens. They became the land and the oceans and the forests. The Haida myths tell of Raven picking up a clam and dropping the clam on a beach, and from that clam crawled the first human beings. Well, today it's science that is providing many insights into these questions. And when you think about the answers that science is providing to these ancient questions, they're every bit as fantastic as the creation myths in cultures around the world. To me, one of the most astonishing developments in the last 40 years has been our insights into DNA, the genetic material, and the ways that scientists can now manipulate this genetic material. And one of the amazing achievements of the 20th century was the actual delineation of the sequence of the 3 billion letters in the DNA in the nucleus of a single human cell, the so-called human genome. To determine the sequence of all the letters in that genome was the equivalent of deciphering all of the words and letters in 1,000 volumes of the complete works of Shakespeare. And scientists, of course, once the human genome was determined, scientists boast that, oh, now we're going to determine the cause of disease and invent new drugs and cure cancer and all this. That's just all bullshit that they say to get more money. But the reality is, the most astonishing discovery that came out of the human genome is that 99% of the genes in our cells are identical to the genes in the great apes. They are our nearest relatives. But more than that, every one of us carries thousands of genes identical to the genes in our pet dogs and cats, identical to the genes in salmon, in eagles, in fruit flies, dandelions, and cedar trees. All life is related through our common evolutionary history. And if we look at other species as our kin, our relatives, surely we treat our relatives in a different way from something that we simply regard as a resource or a pest or a weed or a vermin. I'd like you to perform a thought exercise that may give us a different insight into other species on the planet. Try to imagine that scientists have made a great technological breakthrough. They've discovered time travel, taking us back 4 billion years. That is, we're going to go back in the Earth's history to a time before any life existed on Earth, when the planet was sterile. So I push the button, boom, we're back 4 billion years. And of course, we'd immediately want to know, what is the Earth like before there was life on it? So we all rush to the door, rush out, and every one of us is dead as a doornail within 5 minutes. Why? Because before plants evolved on the planet, the air was toxic for an animal like us. It was filled with water vapor, carbon dioxide, and all kinds of other stuff, but there was no oxygen. Oxygen became a part of the atmosphere when plants discovered photosynthesis and began to produce oxygen as a byproduct. It is life that created the very air that animals like us depend on, and to this very day, it is all the green things in the oceans and on land that are taking carbon dioxide out of the air and putting oxygen back in it. Our crisis with climate, of course, is that we are overwhelming the capacity of green things to absorb the carbon we're generating by burning more and more fossil fuels, and that is accumulating as greenhouse gases around the planet. Okay, we knew that there wouldn't be any air that was breathable, so if you reach under your seat, every one of you will find a big tank of compressed air there. So we put the tank on our backs and put our mask over our face, turn on the tank, and out we go. After a few hours, remember there was a lot of water vapor and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It was very warm on the surface of the planet. After a while, I would think, be pretty thirsty. Where would you find something to drink before there was any life on it? I mean, there's lots of water around it, but life is an integral part of the hydrologic cycle. It's life that filters the water as it percolates through the soil. We get our water in Vancouver from 3 watersheds surrounded by old-growth rainforest, and all of the tree roots and the other plants and soil fungi and bacteria filter that water so that we can drink it. Before there was any life on Earth, where could we find water that we would trust to drink? So again, it's life that cleansed the water, that cleanses the water for us so that we can drink. Okay, well, we knew that. If you reach further under your chair, there's a big glass bottle, not plastic, you don't want to ruin your sex life. There's a glass bottle of water. So we clip that onto our helmet, there's a little straw, and we can drink that water, and so we're all happy as a clam. But after a few more hours, I would imagine you'd get hungry. Where would you find anything to eat before there was any life on Earth? Every bit of the food that we eat for our nutrition was once alive. So before there was any life on Earth, animals like us could never find anything to eat. Well, we knew that too. I've got a big stash of food here. But not only that, we're going to stay for a couple of weeks. So I even brought some seeds to plant for. Maybe we could have some greens and supplement our food. Where would we find soil to plant our seeds? Oh, there's plenty of dust and clay and gravel and sand. But before life appeared, there was no soil anywhere on Earth, because soil is created by life. As life dies and gives up its macromolecules, it mixes with the matrix of sand and clay and eventually becomes soil. So before there was any life on Earth, there was no soil and there was nothing for an animal like us to eat. After the sun sets, I would imagine we've been around now for 4 billion years ago for a while, we'd get a bit homesick. And maybe some of us would like to light a fire. So before there was any life on Earth, where would we find anything to burn on the planet? Wood, peat, dung, oil, coal, gas. All of that is created by plants. Plants that capture the sun's energy through photosynthesis and then store it in their carcasses. Before there was any life on Earth, there was no fuel for us to burn. Well, again, we knew that. I brought some wood and kindling and paper. So we curl up the paper, we put the kindling on and the wood, and then we take a match. And guess what? Before there was any life on Earth, there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. There was no fire on the planet. So the point of this thought exercise is that it's the web of living things, what scientists call biological diversity, biodiversity. Our relatives, the plants and other animals around the earth, that create the very things that keep us alive. And to this day, they are the source of the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and the capturing of sunlight through photosynthesis. We boast, our great boast is that we're intelligent. Oh, we're a clever animal. But what intelligent creature, knowing that air, water, and soil are the critical elements that keep us alive, knowing that other species are what generate our most primary needs, would then proceed to use air, water, and soil as a toxic dump of the most potent chemicals ever devised, that would then proceed to destroy habitat and species. It drives species to extinction at a rate not seen on the planet for 65 million years. We fool ourselves if we think that we can extirpate 50,000 species a year, destroy ecosystems, and poison our surroundings and not think it will affect us. Scientists can use DNA to trace the movement of our species through time. Another astonishing feat. And all of the trails lead back to Africa. We're all Africans. So that makes me laugh when I see the Ku Klux Klan and all these guys, these pointy-headed guys. They're Africans, for God's sakes. We all are. We were born in the plains of Africa, and try to imagine what the world was like when our species appeared on Earth. There were still woolly mammoths on the planet. There were saber-toothed tigers and Tasmanian devils. The world was a very different place, and the Serengeti must have been filled with animals in size and number beyond anything we can imagine today. So thinking back in that way, these funny-looking two-legged naked apes were not very impressive. I'm sure that no other species looked at us and went, "Oh my God, watch out for those critters, they're going to take over the planet." I mean, what the hell did we have going for us? There weren't very many of us. We weren't very big or strong or fast, and we certainly weren't endowed with sensory ability. I keep trying to imagine swinging through the trees on a vine without my glasses. I mean, no way I would survive. And of course, this very ordinary looking ape that was our ancestors had an ability that was invisible. It was hidden from view because it was buried deep in his skull. It was a 2-kilogram organ, the brain, that was the secret to our success. That brain was the most complex structure that we know of in the universe. That brain endowed us with a massive memory, with curiosity, and creativity. And those qualities conferred by the brain more than compensated for our lack of physical or sensory ability. That brain was aware of itself, and it was aware of itself in time and space. That's a remarkable thing. That brain was able to look out and observe and analyze those observations. It remembered things. It tried. It learned things by trial and error. That brain was able to imagine a future using its experience and accumulating knowledge. That brain imagined what a future could be like. And we could dream of a world that didn't exist, but that might be, a world in which we avoid dangers and exploit opportunities. And by dreaming of that future, we could make it happen, because we could then determine how to act in order to reach that future. Foresight was the great advantage we had over any other species on the planet. And foresight, by looking ahead and imagining that future, we in fact were able to become the dominant animal on the planet in only 150,000 years. We moved onto every continent. And just to get an idea of the explosive change that has happened, when the agricultural revolution began 10,000 years ago, there were only 10 million human beings on the planet. That's all over the earth, 10,000 years ago. When Jesus Christ was said to be born, there were estimated to be 100 million people. So that's a tremendous increase in only 2,000 years. But then it took almost 2,000 more years, about 200 years ago, when we finally reached the first billion people on Earth. And today, that number in only 200 years has exploded to 6.8 billion, and by the middle of this century, it could be up to 9 billion. We are now the most numerous mammal on the planet. There's a law, or there seems to be a rule, that the bigger you are, the fewer animals there are. Any species, the number seems to be a function of size. So the smaller you are, the more of you there are. So when you're a whale or an elephant, the numbers are in the thousands, whereas when you're a tiny creature, the number can be in the tens of millions. We have gone against that principle. We are now the most numerous mammal species on the planet. There are more of us than all the mice. There are more of us than all the rats, than all the rabbits. So, and we're a hell of a lot bigger than them. And the mere fact of living means that every one of us needs to breathe the air. We need to drink water, eat food, clothe and shelter ourselves. Simply surviving means that we have a very large ecological footprint as a species. It takes a lot of land, air, and water to support us, just to keep us alive. But of course, we're not like rabbits or rats or mice. And we have virtually all of modern technology has been created in the last 150 years, from cars and telephones and radios, right up through satellites and birth control pills and iPhones and all of that stuff. All of that has become a part of our lives in less than 150 years. And all of that amplifies our exploitation of the planet. We have also increased radically since the last World War our consumptive patterns. My mother and father were born before the Great Depression, and they lived through the Depression as adults. And they taught us very simple things that they had learned as Depression survivors. Live within your means. Save some for tomorrow. You need money for the necessities in life, but you don't run after money as if it makes you a better, more important person. Help your neighbor, because there'll come a time when you'll need help from your neighbor. Those simple things have all changed. They've been thrown out as consumption has become a fundamental part of our economy. And now we define our very selves as consumers. That's our, not as parents or not as Catholics or Jews, but consumers is our primary role in society. And that again amplifies what we have to take out of the earth. And that amplification is accelerated by a global economy that now uses material from all over the planet. And we're not even aware of what we are taking because, you know, materials, you think of your computers, your cars, your television sets, have dozens and dozens of different minerals that have been mined and processed to put into those machines. But we just want to go out and buy a Toshiba or a Sony or a GM car, and we don't understand that the way we act and our consumptive habits affect the entire planet. So when you add all of those things up, our numbers, our technological power, our consumptive patterns, and a global economy, we have become a species as no other species has ever existed in the 3.8 billion years of life on this earth. I remember only a few years ago that we used to refer to storms, to floods and drought, hurricanes, to forest fires as natural disasters, or we called them acts of God. Well, that may have been true a few decades ago, but it sure as hell isn't true today, because you can see the human imprint in all of these phenomena that are occurring. We have become a force of nature. We indeed have tried to assume the place of a God in influencing these forces that affect our lives. We, scientists now, you know, they define different eras by whether it was an ice age or what. There's a Holocene era, and now they call this the Anthropocene era. This is a moment when human beings have become so powerful, we are actually shaping the physical, chemical, and biological features of the planet on a geological scale. To come to grips with how powerful we have become as a species, we have to see the world as it really is, and then see where we belong in that world. The problem is that the way we see the world is shaped by our backgrounds, is shaped by our upbringing, our gender, by our religion, by our socioeconomic class. We learn to see the world in certain ways. Just ask a man and a woman about love or family, and you'd swear they were a different species. I mean, ask a Bay Street investment person with and a Bay Street beggar to talk about money and the economy, and you'll get radically different answers. Ask an Israeli and a Palestinian about Gaza, and you'll get radically different answers. We see the world through the perceptual lenses that are shaped by our background. Many years ago, I went to Peru with Wade Davis, and he took me to a village on a mountain. And he told me that the children there are taught that the mountain that their village is on is an apu. Apu in their language means God. And as long as that mountain casts its shadow on the village, it will determine the fate of all of the people in that village. And Wade said to me, you can imagine how those children, when they grow up, treat that mountain compared to a kid that grows up in Trail BC and is taught all their lives, I'll bet those mountains are full of gold and silver. The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it. Is a forest a sacred grove, or is it simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the veins of the land, or simply an opportunity for irrigation or power? Is another species our biological kin, or simply a commodity or a resource? Is our property a home, or simply real estate? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a speech by famous geneticist, broadcaster, and author David Suzuki.